So I'll begin with a quote. "We were always fighting and demonstrating in those days," was one activist's recollection. "It made me a militant. You had to get into the struggle to survive. We were all in it together. You didn't have time to think of your own troubles." Communist Party member Audrey Blake summed up the Depression years as an, I'll quote, "hard, liberating decade, a mind-opener which showed the possibilities that obtain when the working class struggles for ideas and ideals as well as for the daily crust." As Audrey's comment indicates, the 1930s were a most political decade marked by economic crisis, political volatility, protest and revolutionary upheavals, repression and reaction, and of course a decade of misery for many with extreme poverty and hardship. It was a time when Australia's unemployment rates were second only to those in Germany, peaking at around 30% overall in mid-1932, while rates of 33% for working-class men were found in suburbs such as Fitzroy. The decade contained huge, sometimes revolutionary struggles such as the Spanish Civil War, coupled with the growth of the left, especially the Communist Party. On the right, the rise of fascism and right-wing organisations threatened working class gains and triggered World War II. In Australia, working class women were often in the forefront of the struggle and resistance, one unemployed activist remarking, "If there is to be trouble, we will take our share of it." So I'm going to begin by setting the scene for the Depression years, the militancy of the 20s, then look at some of the economic features of that time, especially around women's employment. I'll cover some of the key struggles of the Depression years and conclude with some of the sort of the legacy and lessons of this period. And in along the way, really challenging a lot of the myths about working women's history. But before I go, I will plug Rebel Women, the new printing that we're going to have the launch tomorrow, lunchtime. And you'll have to find out more about the 1930s in Janie's chapter in this book, as I've used some different material. And of course, there's much more about women in struggle from the 1890s right through to 1986. So, setting the scene. The militancy of the 1930s didn't happen by chance. Working class women weren't sitting on the sidelines. They were organising on the job for equal pay over unemployment and joining the ALP and left parties in working class struggles and in the fight against fascism. And some of this activism had its origins in the fights around conscription during World War I, the inspiring example of the Russian Revolution, which did have a real impact here and followed by growing union organisation and militancy during the 1920s. Robin Joyce writes about the situation in Western Australia, and she says, "Between 1917 and the Depression, women attempted to make industrial gains. Many had been involved in political activity prior to 1917, some in New South Wales and Victoria, and others in the suffrage movement of the 1890s. Jean Beadle, for example, who was an organiser for the Food Preservers Union and active in the ALP in Perth, had set up a support group for the 1892 Broken Hill strike while she was still in Victoria." And I only found that out a little while ago. And Joyce adds, "Women's action in the 1920s to improve their working conditions could hardly be described as insignificant. Women showed that they were prepared to strike, lose their jobs, or sustain police convictions. They were eager to take individual action as well as follow strong leadership and to support militant activity. Women were also keen publicists of their cause through letters to the newspaper, and I'd add, you know, through a number of other ways as well. And they supported each other, helping those who suffered job losses with financial and other aid." Less well-documented activists, such as sisters Kathleen and Helen McIntyre, were both militant unionists and ALP leaders. And I want to just point out here that we say, you know, I often say that women are in the unions or they're in the ALP, but very often they were also leaders within those organisations, and I don't think we emphasise that enough. Anyway, Kathleen McIntyre combined work in the Clerical Workers Union and the ALP, while Helen was an organiser with the Hospitality Union and in many positions within the ALP. She was particularly active during the 1920s, a stormy industrial period in Perth, where she was fined and criticised in the press for demonstrating publicly and using unsuitable language. As the McIntyre sisters show, there was increasing involvement of women on the political front, from rank and file to leadership levels in the formation and development of the ALP. And although the Communist Party was much smaller, only forming in 1921 in Sydney and from 1931 in Western Australia, women were active as rank and file members and in leadership positions. And it was these activists, especially those in the CPA, who often led the 1930s struggles and resistance, pushing militancy rather than compromise with the system. And again, I really want to emphasise the role of the Communist Party for all its faults during this period. Now, I'll give an example of Cecilia Shelley, who wasn't in the Communist Party, but still close to them at different times. Cecilia Shelley gives an example of how militancy grew in the 1920s and how women's membership of unions contributed to a steady strengthening of the movement overall. As well as her union work, she was very active in the ALP. Apart from a four-year period where she was expelled for supporting the British seamen's strike, public criticism of the party, and being sympathetic to the CPA. And wasn't surprising, really, as she described herself as walking on air when she heard about the Russian Revolution. For her, it showed that workers could rise up with real force. She knew and worked with CPA leader Catherine Susanna Pritchard, including starting up the Perth branch of the Movement Against War and Fascism in the 1930s. As a young working-class woman, Cecilia worked in a number of hospitality jobs, as people did at that time, and today for that matter. One such was the Albany Tea Rooms, where workers got lunch but no breaks and worked long hours. And she recalls her first protest action. Fellow worker Lil said, "We're going to stop at 11 for a cup of tea. Will you join us?" I said, "I'll be in it, Lil." So at 11 o'clock, Lil got a cup of tea ready. We stood there, trembling from head to foot, and had this cup of tea and a piece of bread and butter. From then on, they had a short break at 11. She went on to be organiser and then lead, and that's a long name, the Hotel Club Caterers, Tea Rooms and Restaurant Employees Union, which became quite powerful. She led one of the shortest strikes and apparently her fiery personality and toughness led to her being dubbed the Tigress of Trades Hall. She led one of the shortest strikes in history after some hotels refused to abide by a new agreement. Cecilia went from hotel to hotel calling, "Up! All up!" The strike ended within a couple of hours as hoteliers, fearful of loss of trade, quickly agreed to apply the New Deal. A 22-week strike in 1921 drew widespread support with picket lines and rallies of up to 7,000, where John Curtin spoke. On one of the picket lines, Cecilia was arrested as a troublemaker. The strike oversacking a union as collecting dues unfortunately ultimately failed, and in its wake, membership of the union fell by 20%, but that didn't daunt sort of the activists. So another hotel strike in 1925 over a claim for a 44-hour week, an increase of 5 shillings a week, and a union preference clause was more successful. When employers rejected the claim outright, around 2,000 workers, mostly women, went on strike. A pre-strike meeting attracted over 1,400, where the rank and file women participated vocally in the debate. During the strike, the unionists picketed, held rallies, and even sang and danced around the dining tables, apparently including some uncouth language, so there we have it again. The papers labelled the strikers, "Amazons on the warpath," "A petticoat government," and "Shelley's army." Hoteliers weren't so happy with one, a Mrs. Thomas of Gordon's Hotel, shouting at the picketers, "I can see Madame Defarge doing her knitting while the heads were falling." And a picketer, possibly Cecilia, quickly yelled back, "We're hoping to cut off your business, not your head," though perhaps they thought that too. So just looking now, moving on to the Depression, the actual sort of Depression years, and the Great Depression from roughly from 29 to 35 had a crushing effect on every aspect of the country. It was more severe and more widespread than that of the 1890s, though the recovery was more rapid. In 1920, unionisation rates were around 42%, only to fall in the Depression to World War I levels around 15%. So that wasn't surprising given 30% unemployment, real national income falling from £121 to £95, and a reduction in the gross domestic product of around a third. The 1931 wages, 1931 wages across the board were cut by 10%, with many employers attempting to drive down rates by a further 15. In other words, a total of a quarter of your wage is gone. However, as mentioned, economic recovery aided by protective tariffs, government contracts, devaluation and decreased labour costs, which came out of the Depression, did stabilise the economy and industries such as manufacturing. So by the end of the 1930s, gross domestic product had reached its highest ever level. Unemployment, though still high, was down to 8.1% and real national income £131, with an accompanying rise in unionisation and industrial action. So where were working women in all of this? Between the wars, it was the new industries and occupations such as commercial, financial, public and professional services that provided the greatest employment growth for women. They were also employed in the industrial sector, an essential part of the economy, with a workforce participation rate of 25% by the 1920s. In fact, at that time, women, from one of the figures I saw, were a majority of Australia's factory workers, and many of them worked in the textile industry, which overall employed a reasonable percentage of the manufacturing workforce, but was also at that time a significant contributor to the nation's wealth. One area where women's employment did decline was the domestic servants, which dropped about 5% between 1911 and 1933, slightly increasing during the Depression years. A standout feature of employment in Australia is that it has one of the highest levels of labour market or occupational segregation. This means that women are concentrated in certain sectors, nursing, education, retail, and in light manufacturing, such as textiles, footwear and clothing, food preservers, tobacco, printing and paper, and the like. So in 1933, for example, the degree of occupational segregation of women and men was quite extreme. 41% of women worked in occupations where equal to or greater than 90% of the workers were women. 68% of women were in occupations where equal to or greater than 50% of workers were female. Another way of looking at it, during 1931-32, 48% of Tasmania's and 23% of Victoria's female employees worked in textiles, which are, you know, traditionally female-dominated. But paradoxically, it meant that during the Depression years, women lost fewer jobs and were out of work for shorter periods because their industries were more protected, or in such areas as nursing or education, where they still needed the same numbers. However, some caution is needed here with the figures, as hidden unemployment, such as married women or underemployment, do skew the picture a bit. An estimated 4 or 5% of women dropped out of the labour force altogether and were not counted as unemployed. And as well, women became ineligible for relief payments or employment schemes, though sometimes they organised and protested at the local council to demand and win government support. There are other ways of getting women off the unemployment lists. In Melbourne in 1931, there were 4,000 young women receiving sustenance. By 1933, there were only 238. Not because they found jobs in Melbourne, but because the government changed the eligibility criteria and adopted a policy of sending young single women out into country areas where they got bored in exchange for domestic work. Among those who did keep working, such as some domestic servants, shop assistants and clerical workers, often only part-time or reduced hours were available. As one woman commented, it was always called part-time during the Depression, but it meant working a bloody sight longer for less. Teachers and nurses faced almost no unemployment, though married women did lose their jobs in teaching after New South Wales legislation was brought in 1932. While there was widespread opposition to the dismissal of married women, it wasn't until 1947 in that state that the legislation was review, you know, was reversed. And in fact, it's possible for that the figures really show that for married women, unemployment could have been higher than for single women, but you have to really sort of delve into the figures to establish that. Unlike the male labour force, however, which did decline during the early 30s, despite the job losses, the female labour force and labour force participation continued to grow slowly, although slightly. Overall, in the interwar years, women's employment fluctuated between 20 and 22%, slightly over the growth in population. And while all workers had wages reduced by 10% by the arbitration court in 1931, it does appear that female wages, already sometimes as low as 50 to 60% of the male rate, were cut more than men's. And this put families in a dire position as women became the breadwinners when men found it harder to get work. And depending on the state, between about 19.3% to 25% of women were breadwinners for the family by 1933. Some industries, as I said, such as the textile industry, bounced back quite quickly after a slump in 1927, supported as it was by the high tariff walls. This gave women a stronger industrial position, though that was not necessarily always taken advantage of. But not only were more women working, they were part of a non-manual workforce which was being unionised for the first time in the 1920s and 30s. Nursing, bank officers and insurance clerks were among that number, in part driven to organise to face the challenges of new technology, in part because of changing industrial laws which gave some more legal backing to unionisation. These new unions, however, were less political than the blue-collar unions, remaining outside the peak organisations and avoiding political ties. Except that, you know, a union like the AWU didn't join the ACTU till quite late. So there were some other, you know, male-dominated unions that weren't part of the peak union organisation. But amongst women, particularly in nursing, the union officials, well, not the union officials, but the leadership of the associations in the nurses' union had long resisted unionisation, preferring to stay as a professional association. So in 1931, Evelyn Evans, who was secretary of the New South Wales Nurses Association, wrote, "Alas, it is too true. Some of the misguided members of the profession called a meeting of nurses and decided to form a union. I regret to say that some of the leading lights of the Nurses Association were present and were in favour of the suggestion, some of them even accepting positions on the committee." She was devastated. So now onto the Depression years of the 30s themselves. Politically, the 1930s seemed to have a sense of being faced with only two choices: socialism or barbarism. On the one hand, I'm not saying that Jack Lang was at the leadership of the revolutionary movement, but he did win government in New South Wales in November 1930 on a radical agenda, and Labor did hold government in a number of states and on occasions federally. The Spanish Civil War gave hope to many, while the Russian Revolution seemingly delivered a workers' state, or at least the early stages of one. From the mid-1930s, unionisation was increasing and the Communist Party was growing. On the other hand, there was a rise of fascism in Europe, the most serious threat in Spain, and of course here with the paramilitary New Guard and other organisations with some thousands of members. One writer suggests that the 30-strong Old Guard, which was a far-right organisation, came within 24 hours of attempting to overthrow Lang's government, prevented only by the state's governor sacking of Lang. Many on the far left thought a socialist revolution or disaster was imminent. On May Day in 1935, the revolutionary CPA leader Jean Devaney asserted, and I'll quote, "World war, world revolution, either might happen before next May Day." In the early 1930s, the left took to the streets almost weekly with agitational campaigns, with consistently large audiences for Sunday rallies at Sydney's Domain. And Jean Devaney describes her sort of routine, often quite hectic, and she writes, 7 a.m. would find me at one or other of the dog dumps, as the ration distributing centres were called, or down on the wharves, perhaps the trades hall at mid-morning, then a lunch hour factory gate. Every afternoon I spoke in a suburb, and at 8 at night, again, a suburban meeting or in town. Talks would go for 1 to 2 hours with another hour for questions. She didn't do that every day, but, you know. But not for nothing was she labelled a red revolutionist and a ranter. Devaney reflected some of the changes in society that opened more doors for women. As Muriel Heaney wrote in 1932, in the last 50 years, the social and economic status of women has completely changed, bringing with it a new psychology. No longer, and she quotes, protected in the home as an appendage of man, women consciously demand recognition of the fact that women's right to work rests not on the number of her dependents, nor on the fact that she does or does not compete with men, but in the absolute right of a free human being, a taxpayer and a voter, to economic independence. And like men, workplace conditions or pay was a catalyst that precipitated women into industrial action. It was similarly the case around unemployment, where women helped organise relief when the government failed to provide any assistance and rallied and fought against measures like Work for the Dole. A major feature of women's activism and resistance was its collective nature. Women joined unions, the ALP and the Communist Party to further their cause, as well as some of the more reformist women's organisations, such as a group called the United Associations of Women, who did take a stand on some things. In the desperate circumstances of the Depression, however, the Communist Party was the only one to consistently mobilise militancy, many times attracting large numbers of women to public actions, such as unemployed eviction struggles, protest rallies and confrontations over government assistance. The party also played a significant role in strikes, including those in female-dominated workplaces. They organised conferences of militant women and local women's groups on a scale which really belied its modest size and tiny female membership. Phil Griffiths, in his study of women and the CPA, writes, and Janie has this example as well in her chapter, one celebrated example came when employers at Victorian spinning mills announced a 15% wage cut in 1932. One factory took quick strike action and forced management to reduce the cut in their factory to 7.5%. It was a significant victory, though